From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we speak with the director of the Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson. Then the newly named executive director of the Freshwater Collaborative talks about her goals for the program.
We want research that links the entire university system. The idea is that we bring students in to one university, but then they can share resources amongst all 13.
Plus, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton talks about the fast approaching Mars 2020 mission.
I mean, talk about optimism. The fourth goal that this mission has is to help prepare for people landing on Mars.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. As many of you may know, June is Pride Month in honor of the Stonewall Uprising of 1969 in New York's Greenwich Village. Recently, demonstrations for the Black Lives Matter movement and Pride have converged, a move that harkens back to Pride's roots as a movement against police brutality and oppression, led by LGBTQ people of color. One of those leaders was Marsha P. Johnson, a gay liberation activist and self-identified drag queen who was keenly aware of the violence and abuse her community was facing. In 1992, her body was found in the Hudson River, and her suspicious death remains unsolved today. In the 2017 Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, director David France follows activist Victoria Cruz as she tries to find out what led to the death of her friend Marsha. To learn more about the documentary, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with France via Zoom from his home in New York City.
David France, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking a few moments to speak with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, dives into the unresolved death of Marsha. But first, I want to concentrate on her life. So who was Marsha?
Marsha was this extremely well-known and beloved figure in New York. She was an early organizer in the community in the 60s. She was considered herself a drag queen, to use the vernacular of the day. And she was kind of a mother to many other young trans people in the city. And she was turned out to be an instrumental figure at the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. Some have credited her with touching off the rebellion, but what's more true is that when she arrived after the conflagration had already began, she led a fierce flank of people into the fray and is known as one of the frontline battlers that night. But also, after that, she and her comrade Sylvia Rivera joined about a dozen other people to begin building the foundations for the modern LGBT movement that took hold after those riots. And so she's really an architect of so much of what the movement has attained over all these years. And then she and Sylvia also started the world's first transgender organization. They had conceived for the first time ever of transgender people having their own kind of social, cultural, and political needs and concerns and affinities. And in that way, she was a true revolutionary.
Yeah, the organization you refer to is the STAR organization, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. And I think it's such a true example of grassroots ingenuity, personal, not just accountability, but motivation and drive. And many people today, you know, within these past few years are becoming more aware of transgender issues. But as you say, with Marsha's example, she was the Rosa Parks of the LGBT movement. And this documentary really shows how longstanding a lot of these issues have been for the transgender community.
Absolutely. If it weren't for her, this whole conversation about gender and gender identity may have been delayed for many years. And it's really apt and appropriate that we're speaking about her and Sylvia Rivera today, the day that the Supreme Court just issued one of the most significant rulings in recent years, in which they make it federal law. It is now illegal to fire people for their transgender identity, as well as to fire gay people and lesbians simultaneously. But it's really a major, major victory at the Supreme Court. And it would be tremendous if both of those historical figures were alive today to see the outcome of the revolution that they started.
Most definitely. So obviously, Marsha holds great significance for the LGBTQ plus community. But what drew you to her story to make this documentary? This documentary more so focuses on the unsolved death of Marsha in 1992.
Well, I should start by saying that I knew Marsha, but she was kind of a mother figure to the community back in the early days. I moved to New York in the early 80s, and she was one of the first people I was introduced to in the city. It was like, if you wanted to feel like New York was your home as a young gay or lesbian person, you really needed Marsha's blessing in a way. Once we became friends, she was a daily fixture on Christopher Street, which was then the kind of mountaintop of queer life in New York. And then she would call your name day or night and wish you a happy evening. And that made you feel like you had arrived. She really expanded the community by throwing her arms open and bringing people in and making them feel at home. When she died in 92, I remember where I was when I got the news. And I was working at the time at the Village Voice, an alternative newspaper in New York. And I drew the assignment to investigate what might have happened to her. The circumstances were murky, mysterious. The police were very obviously unwilling to investigate. And so I began for a while doing my own investigation into the events of that night in 1992. But for a number of reasons, the principal one being that 1992 was a terrible year for taking a turn in the AIDS epidemic. And my partner at the time grew very sick. I abandoned the story, and my partner died in the winter of that year. And by that time, it was 6 months past her death, and I just never returned to the investigation. And I always felt that it was unfinished business, and that I really owed Marsha's memory the attention that I should be giving to this investigation around her passing. In serious ways, the memory of Marsha had faded, as had the memory of Sylvia, from the kind of the oral histories that we've been passing down to one another in the community. And I wanted to elevate both her life and try and bring justice to her surrounding the matter of her death. But the timing for this was the massive increase in violence against the transgender community over the last decade. Especially transgender women of color. And I thought if Marsha's case can go unresolved and unremembered, then what hope did any of these newer and younger victims have of finding justice in their case? So I thought it'd be very symbolic to go back to that time in 1992 and see what sense could be made of.
Throughout the documentary, you go through archival pieces and interviews you collected. And as you mentioned, no police, no city resources dedicated their time to finding out exactly what happened to resolve Marsha's death. And you highlight kind of the picking up of the baton through Victoria Cruz to be our guide through this story. So why was she an effective way to frame the documentary?
Well, Victoria Cruz is, first of all, a major historical figure of her own, was also there on that fateful June night in 1969. And she had devoted her life and her life's work to responding to violence and other crimes against the LGBT community. And as a contemporary of Marsha's, she was one of the people that I first talked to. And she felt that it was at the end of her career, she was about to retire, that she thought that this could be her swan song, that it was something that she could do and something she was driven to do. something she had the skills to do. And she was keen to let me join her in that journey. And she's a tireless investigator and a charming figure. So she really helped bring that story and that time in New York City to life in a way that is so vibrant and human.
During the Stonewall era, you mentioned Sylvia, who claimed the street people and the drag queens were the vanguards of the movement. But as you mentioned, the pride movement seemed to grow out of touch with this, and only recently are people reacquainting themselves with people such as Marsha. And Sylvia stated in a speech she made at the 1973 Pride that she felt betrayed by the pride movement, where it was going, that they forgot about people like her and Marsha. How do you see the modern pride movement relearning this history and also remembering its roots in activism and the trans women who led it?
Well, you're right about that terrible turn in the early years of the movement. Star was one of the four or five major components of the early movement. And in 1973, just 4 years in, they were evicted from the movement. They were thrown out of the umbrella organization Gay Activist Alliance, and they were forsaken by the movement that they had helped start. It was a very cruel moment in the history of the movement, one that has not been adequately addressed, I don't think. But that speech that she gives in 1973 is a heartbreaking speech. She had to fight her way onto the stage to defend the role of trans women and street people, as she called them, the marginalized corners of our community, defend their right to be there and to do that work and to be recognized for the work that they had already accomplished. And it did no good. She was booed off the stage and she left the movement for many, came back to the movement after Marsha's untimely death. Marsha was found floating in the Hudson River, and that brought Sylvia back as a kind of a public person, as an activist. But by 1992, the movement in New York had become very kind of commercial. What had been called the Gay Pride March was suddenly being called the Gay Pride Parade, with floats sponsored by credit card companies and local businesses and international businesses. And the tenor changed really dramatically. And that has been a really unfortunate fact about Pride, that Pride has become a kind of a commercial marketing idea. In the recent years, in New York City and in other cities as well, there have been kind of breakaway groups that call themselves Reclaim Pride, who bring back the idea that, as they say, Stonewall was a riot, and they have organized contingents or counter demonstrations to coincide with Gay Pride Day. The Reclaim Pride people have said, inspired by the movement for Black Lives that has really energized so many people throughout the country and even throughout the world, that they are mounting a demonstration on Pride Day this year in New York in defense of Black and brown lives, in defense of transgender people of color in the community, and against the police violence and police militarization that has been the calling cry now of this new movement as it's swelling in the country.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the Black Lives Matter movement is getting some new, you know, not just allyship, but that pride organizations around the U.S. are realizing we need to get back to this activism and roots, and the issues of police brutality against the LGBTQ plus community have been longstanding. It's something Marsha and Sylvia were fighting against and what Stonewall was about. And now there's the influx of including Black trans lives, particularly Black women who are trans, and the violence that has always been against them. And while Marsha's case has been cold, like many transgender cases, most recently there were also two deaths just last week of Rhea Milton and Dominique Fells. So do you believe that there's been any like true significance progress when it comes to bringing visibility to trans lives and the violence against trans women of color, especially?
Unfortunately, it's really unfinished business. You know, of all of the archival materials that I found while making the film about Marsha, the most surprising to me and important, I think, was an audio taped interview that Marsha had organized in 1992 of the transgender women who were working in the sex trade along the side of the Hudson River that summer. And they were all being physically tormented by the police. And she had taken it upon herself to call in the media to bring to light the violent treatment that was being handed down by the local police precinct. That, coupled with some other evidence that Victoria Cruz pulls together in the course of the film, leads you to believe that the most likely understanding of what happened to her on the night that she fell into the river was that she was put there or chased there by the police themselves. So this idea of police violence going unanswered has a long history, including especially within the queer community, but the community of color across the board.
You end the documentary with Victoria packing up all of her notes on the Marsha case to hopefully be looked into by someone at the FBI. But there's still no concrete answer, and that was definitely a powerful way to end the documentary. How do you hope this impacts viewers? Because it shows there's no, quote, happy ending after watching this.
Well, the work is still not finished. And I think that we took it as far as we could with the current policies and leadership in the New York City Police Department. And I am really heartened by the progress that's already been made in this short several weeks since the murder of George Floyd across the country. But in New York State, finally, they repealed a law that made it illegal to get any information on allegations of misconduct against police. Now, with that possibility now available to us, I think we're going to finally be able to get into those police files and find out what exactly was going on in that police precinct where Marsha's life had been so endangered, but also across the city and state to find out what the secrets that the police have been keeping from the community and from the people they were meant to serve over all these years, and what stories that they reveal.
People are starting to get to know Marsha again. A whole new generation is learning who she was, especially as the Black Lives Matter marches coincide with Pride and harkening back to its activist roots. How does it make you feel that Marsha is once again at the forefront of Pride?
Well, I think certainly that that's where Marsha belongs and Sylvia belongs. And for the whatever small role I played in it, I'm really pleased to think that people now who never met her, who are born generations after her, now know about Marsha, know about her significant contributions. You know, as a political strategist, she had a very unique approach to creating change, and she did it through joy and glee, really, as her kind of political sword and shield. And as we move forward now in this new thrust in our efforts to defend social justice, I hope that we can learn from those tools of hers to help us as we move forward. And she's such a transformative figure that I believe that we all need to know about her. And I think she's really one of those canonical political forces that should be in all history books.
Well, your documentary certainly helps in that effort. And David France, I want to thank you for your time today to speak about it.
Thank you, Audrey.
David France is the director of the Netflix documentary, The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson, streaming now. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up, we meet the new executive director of the Freshwater Collaborative of Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A statewide research initiative is underway which involves all of the UW system's four-year campuses. It's called the Freshwater Collaborative of Wisconsin. The hope is this initiative will make Wisconsin and UW schools global leaders in freshwater science, technology, and entrepreneurship. The group hopes to enroll hundreds of students, raise research dollars, and create jobs. UW-Milwaukee is taking the lead on this collaboration. Its position near Lake Michigan and the Milwaukee River Basin make it the ideal location to head up this project. Marissa Jablonski was recently named the executive director of the Freshwater Collaborative. She brings her diverse experience from water distribution and sanitation projects in Guatemala to textile wastewater treatment in India. WUWM's Susan Bent spoke with Jablonski at South Shore Park in Bayview. She shares her vision for the work ahead and why it's so important.
We have 13 campuses with professors and staff who have extreme expertise in Great Lakes, Great Rivers, creeks and streams, wetlands, inland lakes. The Driftless is all to it, right? It's amazing, cold water streams. And we want everybody on planet Earth to realize this expertise is real. And using support from the UW University of Wisconsin system, we can help people expand their research, existing research and future research, to be more interdisciplinary, to be more inclusive, and to basically apply it to the whole world.
So we mentioned experience. You've come to this job with Natural Resources Management and Spanish undergrad degree, a master's and PhD in engineering. Correct me when I'm done with this if I'm wrong.
Sure.
You've coordinated sustainable development projects, including water distribution and sanitation in Guatemala. That's just one. That's the short list.
Yeah, okay.
So as you look at this position, it's all new. The position is new. The collaborative is new. It's just so much. So as you begin to pull this together, what are you drawing on to help you pick up steam, to pull the pieces together?
So if we want Wisconsin to be the water center of the world and to be this resource where everybody comes together, then we have to look like everyone, number one. And so Engineers Without Borders at University of Wisconsin Milwaukee,
which you created or helped to create.
I helped to create, yep. I was a part of a founding member many years ago. And we work really closely with an indigenous association in Guatemala, because what we realized is we were outside engineers coming in, solving, put that in quotation marks, other people's problems without being a part of that community or those communities, which we can now see was actually a mistake and can do great amounts of harm. So running the Freshwater Collaborative, I see a lot of overlap there. How can the Freshwater Collaborative solve problems? Well, we can't, right? What we have to do is work with communities and train students of various backgrounds, all backgrounds, hopefully, to solve future problems, right? We're not the ones solving the problems. The young people who are learning what they need to go back to their communities are solving the problems in their communities.
Is there an experience that comes top of mind when it, of something that you personally experienced in working on a project and sort of being knocked in the head saying, oh, we're missing something here?
Yeah, the example that sticks out in my head was my work in wastewater treatment in rural parts of India. So this was my PhD work. I wrote a bunch of grants, and this was under the advising of Dr. John Reisel at UW-Milwaukee. And I traveled to rural India with mentors and professors from the National Environmental Engineering Research Institute. And we developed a low-cost wastewater treatment for textile dye wastewater, right? Because small-scale dyers are dumping their dye waste directly onto the soil, and then it's running inevitably into water resources. So either into the nearby rivers and streams or soaking into their groundwater, which ultimately becomes drinking water. So I thought, oh my gosh, this is a major problem. I can solve this. I'm an engineer. Let me do this as my PhD.
it's been about a month on the job for you. Just, you know, quiet month. So you've toured or virtually toured all of the system, or are you in the midst?
How
far in are you?
Not very far at all. We're organizing what that can look like. And one of the stuck points is do we use Zoom? Do we use Microsoft Teams? What do we use? Like, what is the online platform and who should show up and how long will this take? Because really, these tours will continue once COVID lifts. So I'm trying to figure out how to facilitate a different kind of conversation. That's actually one of the things that's going to grow from that is about 2 years ago, each campus, they sent us their water programs in order to be a part of the bigger freshwater collaborative. That's what we're ultimately creating, is to take out the redundancy and say, okay, if a student wants to study river resources, for instance, they might go to UW La Crosse. But then if they find interest in lakes, Great Lakes, they might spend one semester at UW Milwaukee. That exchange, we're hoping, is mandatory for the students who enter into the collaborative. So we've got the College of Natural Resource from Stevens Point. We've got social science behind water resources up in UW Stout, just to name a couple more. I mean, the opportunities are really amazing. But the idea is that we bring students in to one university, but then they can share resources amongst all 13. So in order to program this, each of the universities sent in their water programs for us to assess and make a big network so that everything can overlap. And we just need to touch base and say, is this still what you want? And are you still on board in this way?
What are some of the projects, the initiatives that you think could come out of this? Or is the initial focus in increasing faculty and in, you know, maybe in concert with pulling in students, undergrad and grads? Because you want coordinated research, right?
Right.
And we want research that links the entire university system. So, for instance, we just accepted between 16 and 20 research grants that included, had an undergraduate research piece to them, and from 11 of the 13 campuses, and there was a requirement that they are collaborative. We had proposals covering topics like microplastics in our freshwater, PFAS, nitrogen crediting in potato production, fish spawning, groundwater recharging. These are fascinating topics. Arsenic detention, purification methods, phosphorus contamination, sustainable urban systems. That's a great idea. Flood resilience and human activity indicators post COVID-19. So the idea is that if 11 out of 13 campuses are involved in these state-of-the-art research opportunities that mandate undergraduate students are also involved, how can we not create the future of clean fresh water?
These are just extraordinary times. It probably motivates you even more when people are here and everywhere are grappling with COVID and people are protesting because things aren't right.
Well, and we're in this together. So if climate change affects our life, if we run out of fresh drinking water, we all run out of fresh drinking water. The only difference is some communities can pay money for those resources to last slightly longer, right? But the reality is, yes, these are extraordinary times, and we cannot move forward without everybody at the table. It doesn't make sense, and it won't actually work. It won't be long-lasting. And we need, a friend of mine just said, she said, make sure that the Freshwater Collaborative is resilient, which means bringing all of the different minds together at the same table, because they're all experts and they're all valid perspectives. Without them, it won't be resilient, it won't be sustainable, the program.
Or the world.
My goodness.
So you told me earlier that you're laying the groundwork for an advisory board. What's your vision? Why is that necessary, and what should it look like?
One of the key points in the Freshwater Collaborative is that we need the students that we train and that graduate, we need them to get jobs. The industry that hire, the water industry and what seems like the non-water industry, but that totally includes water, they have stated that their new hires don't know enough about water resources and water management, and they don't know enough about water. And so we need to make sure that we help create a pipeline for our students to get hired. And that means working with industry so that expectations are managed, right? What do you need your students to learn? Because here's our curriculum that is mandated by the state, but we could offer other opportunities with internships and fellowships and cooperative education across industry and education.
Because you want to inspire students that their voice is important, that their growing expertise is important, and they've got a future in this world of
and
water.
We want the future to be real, right? So if we ignore,
you mean not virtual,
no, right? If we are serious that there are these opportunities, if we really want to tackle PFAS, we need to train students in a way that they can get hired to tackle PFAS.
The big picture goals of the Freshwater Collaborative are training the next generation, which we talked about, of water experts, enroll hundreds of new undergrads and grads, attract $10 to $15 million in new research funding, and create 650 jobs. You're the new and first director. So how much, and I know you're not after control, but how much of a voice do you have in crafting that, in moving toward those big goals?
So I think the way that I look at it is that people are good at what they do. And so we really need to leverage that. So yes, I'm the director, but I'm not alone. There are hundreds of water professors and experts in the state of Wisconsin that have the potential of helping that. There are water industries that include fisheries and agriculture and water tech and water recreation that aren't always thought of that can be grown, right? So yes, those are big numbers, but they're exciting because if everybody does what they're good at, we can grow this thing to unbelievable levels.
And they play together nice.
Yes. Hopefully I hope to have a say in that as well. Some of the work that I've done around the world, I feel has trained me in how to facilitate across boundaries. And sometimes it's just that, you know, industry speaks one language, academia speaks another language, government speaks a third language, and we expect that we understand each other. So how can the Freshwater Collaborative stand in the middle and say, ooh, I think this is what they're saying. Ooh, I think this is what you're saying. Can you guys talk? And we'll see.
So fundamentally, why is this mission important? Or would you say critical?
Yeah, this mission is critical because everybody needs fresh water. We can't live without it. And right now, climate change threatens so much of what our future looks like. Our human health, our environmental health. And I can't imagine a more important look at it. Sorry, we're right by Lake Michigan.
There's beasts in the way.
Yep, and it's just an amazing resource that we have to work with. So I like to say that I was born to talk about how we need to work with planet Earth, not for it, not protecting it. It's bigger than us, right? So we need to work with it. So what an amazing resource, sure, but what an amazing thing, fresh water. And what an important part of our lives.
In the water, children, wade in the water.
Marissa Jablonski is the executive director of the Freshwater Collaborative of Wisconsin. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. Coming up next, our astronomy contributor joins us to talk about Mars 2020. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM.
God's gonna trouble the water.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It seems like the world has been fascinated by Mars for decades. Since unmanned missions began in 1960, there have been 56 missions to Mars from countries around the world. From satellites to rovers, less than half of these missions have been successful, a testament to the hurdles this planet presents. But these problems haven't stopped us. NASA's upcoming Mars 2020 mission will launch in July using the Perseverance rover. The mission hopes to address key scientific goals for Mars exploration. They hope to answer questions about the potential for life on the red planet and collect core samples from its surface. To discuss more about Mars 2020, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with our astronomy contributor Jean Creighton. She begins by explaining the decades of exploration that laid the groundwork for Perseverance.
These conversations started, I think, in the 50s. So the Americans and the Soviet Union at that time were negotiating, which is your planet. This is a little crude, but I think that's basically what it came down to. And the Soviets said, we'll take Venus. And the Americans said, okay, we'll take Mars. Because those are the, you know, the closer on either side of us. And it turns out that the Americans did better because even though the Soviets sent something like 16, 18 missions, the Venera series, Venus is a very hostile planet. So I think we probably have a collective amount of data from Venus from the ground, maybe I'd say all of it is probably under 2 hours. Whereas Mars has been a much more reasonable place, even though Mars is hard. But the Viking landed on Mars in 1978. And there's a wonderful video of one of the engineers who worked on that project. And you can almost cry with him. He's still so emotional about it that the pictures came line by line, line by line. This was the first picture of Mars from the ground. Subsequently, we found out that actually Mars really is hard. And of the 40-some missions that have been sent, 20 have been successful. So we're looking at a 50-50 kind of success rate. And there was a period there for a solid 10 years that we just had no luck whatsoever. The Soviets, the American, all of it just didn't work, you know, flew by, crashed. So the first kind of, when we got back in the game, was with Pathfinder in 1997, I think. So that tells you something about these have been fits and starts. We kind of start and and frankly, I think if Pathfinder hadn't been a success, I think, you know, NASA probably would have pulled the plug and said, you know what, this isn't, let's not do that. There are 8 missions now on Mars still working, and that includes orbiters. That includes landers that don't move and rovers. And people know, I assume, Curiosity, since it's been there for 8 years, I think, now. And InSight landed in 18. And now we're getting ready for the next one. We called it Mars 2020, which has a wonderful ring to it for many years. Its official name now is Perseverance.
So let's get into Perseverance. What is the main objective of this Mars 2020 mission?
They have 4. The 4 ideas is they want to check out the geology with possibility of life in mind. They want to look for what we call biosignatures. And I was really interested to find out that they were training the scientists on the team, who of course will be remotely doing this. Nobody's going to Mars on 2020. This is a machine, right? But they were sent to Australia because Australia has some of the very oldest first signs of life on the planet. And they figure that this is not something you can grasp just by a photograph. You need to really see what is now a rock, but used to be layers upon layers upon layers of bacteria. What does that look like? So that hopefully will, educate their eyes, educate their sensibilities about what this is. There's also a new idea, and that is to have a cache. So you go off, they're going to look in different places. They're very specifically chose. The Jezero crater is very specifically a place that is a dry river delta, and within relatively nearby distances, there's going to be completely different kinds of terrain and maybe very different composition. So they're hoping to send a few, go off on a little mission, and then put together the little tubes of material that hopefully they won't contaminate. That's, of course, another issue. And for a future, for some future spacecraft to come pick it up and bring it home. As you can imagine, even though this rover does have quite a bit of a chemistry toolkit with it, you can't possibly anticipate what is it that you will need. So if we bring it back to Earth, we can use the absolute cutting edge of any kind of equipment that we need, or even build something that we might need, right?
I love that because, you know, some people might say it's one, optimistic to have a mission with caching samples, but the mission right now has no capabilities of bringing these samples back. So there's that optimism of down the road, we'll be able to go back to Mars, pick up these samples, maybe even create new technology to be able to analyze these samples. And ultimately, it's a second phase that is not guaranteed. So is that just the constant optimism of scientists that it'll stay there, we'll come back for it?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it'll stay there. It's not going to go anywhere. But I mean, talk about optimism. The fourth goal that this mission has is to help prepare for people landing on Mars. And I think we can't send people there unless we have some idea of what the soil really is like, how toxic is the environment, you know, measurements about radiation, all kinds of things. So what's interesting is that with this mission, they're testing an instrument called MOXIE, which basically produces oxygen. There is a trivial amount of, there's a trivial atmosphere on Mars, and worse, there's a trivial amount of oxygen. It's mostly carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Mars. And if you had to carry all the oxygen that you would need, I think we would be just dead in the water. That's just too heavy, too impractical. So where possible, you want to create what you need in situ, like use what they've got. So this little machine, it separates the carbon dioxide into oxygen and carbon monoxide, trivial amounts of that. So you get, some lovely oxygen. And that's what you would use to breathe. So this is a proof of concept. It is if this works, then we can scale it up and make it something bigger. But it's one of those things that, you know, breathing is not optional. You'd have to fix this problem. The other innovative thing about this Perseverance is the helicopter that was named Ingenuity. This is an 8-pound helicopter that is designed to fly in an atmosphere that's much thinner than ours. And again, it's a proof of concept. It's going to go off and take aerial pictures to help the scientists and engineers determine where is Perseverance going to go, where is it safe. I mean, we have a pretty good idea, but this would be a much more more high resolution imagery. All of this makes it a very exciting mission. I understand now that the first possible date it could happen is on the 20th of July, although the window ends sometime in August. we're always, of course, at the mercy of the weather. So I'm hoping that next time we speak, it will actually have flown safely already.
Yeah, I hope so too. You were mentioning that Mars has an atmosphere and different levels of oxygen compared to Earth, but Mars also has seasonal cycles that people have been able to observe. So do we know of other planets outside of the Earth that indicate a seasonal pattern as well? And is that a main indicator that there is potential microbial life that makes Mars such a place to explore?
No, not necessarily, but I'm glad you asked. There is something very interesting that's seasonal about Mars that does get people excited. And that is that the concentration of methane changes over the course of the year by a factor of, I think it's 3 or 4, significant. And in the summertime, you get a whole lot more methane. The reason why that's exciting is because methane is a fairly light gas, and left to its own devices, it would leave Earth even, never mind Mars, for Mars even more so. But for Earth, if we didn't have life to constantly replenish methane, we wouldn't have methane in the atmosphere. It would have taken off. And the main producer of methane on Earth is our cows. So it's possible that that methane is a sign that there's microbial life now alive on Mars, either on the surface or more likely in the soil. Now, it's possible that that methane is created by other inorganic processes, but that's, of course, one of the million-dollar questions, right? Where is the methane coming from? And the more we understand about the chemistry and geology of Mars, the better we are to say, to answer the question that you might assume we knew the answer to, is there life right now on Mars? And the answer is we don't know yet. I think it's pretty clear that we don't have any walking, talking creatures on Mars, but whether there's bacteria on Mars, that's yet to be determined. There might be.
And this Mars 2020 mission, if it is successfully available to launch during our window of time coming up, won't land until about February of 2021. But we've also had, as you mentioned, so many missions have been to Mars, and we're in this for the long haul to eventually put humans on Mars. I read about a woman, Alyssa Carson. She's 18 and is already starting her training to be the first person to walk on Mars in projected 2033. Youngest person to graduate from the Advanced Space Academy, and the only person in the world to have completed every NASA space camp. And from real life things like this, preparing for Mars, to science fiction films, movies, it's I don't know if an obsession is a right word, but why do you think it's such a decades-long fascination that we have with this planet?
I think it's because it's the next big thing, right? So we've been to the moon, and yes, it would still take a whole lot of work. It is taking a whole lot of work to go back to the moon. We're hoping to get people, the first woman, yay, in 2024, we're hoping. But Mars is a whole nother game. That's that ramps it up in a way that's significant. I think people get excited about the way of solving problems that would get us successfully to Mars, but also solve problems on Earth. For example, you want to get people to Mars, okay? What are they gonna be eating, right? You can't pack little bags of food. You have to do that for the way there and the way back. But when they're there, surely you can't have enough variety of food before people go stark raving bonkers after 7 months eating the same thing, right? So they're thinking about, okay, so what foods can we carry? What foods are going to be nutritionally appropriate that have enough flexibility, enough variety that, you know, I can make my soybeans to do this today, but tomorrow I'm going to make it into flour and make a cookie. The things of life that, you know, for a few days you can put up with a lot, but if you're going to be there for a couple years, well then, you know, the level of what's acceptable changes. People are doing all kinds of psychological research. Now we all know a whole lot more about isolation than we did before COVID-19. But that's a real issue. How does a group of 5-6 people survive in confined spaces where their life depends on each other? It puts a lot of stress on people. So these are all interesting questions that might give us insight on any number of issues that are real concerns on Earth. I mean, we might get insights from depression to, you know, how to sustainably grow our food, how to manage waste. In Mars, you couldn't possibly just pick up your stuff and just dump it all over the place, right? You have to have multi-use of everything and be very, very careful about what you leave behind.
Well, it's certainly all very exciting things to ponder, and we will eagerly await the launch. And until next time, Jean, it was a pleasure.
As always, Audrey, thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium and our regular astronomy contributor. She and Audrey Nowakowski spoke about the upcoming Mars 2020 mission. If you'd like to learn more about these Mars plans, you can watch Creighton's Moving to Mars program live in July. There's more information and past astronomy segments at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Julian Haida join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz, Emily Files, and Angelina Mosher Salazar from the WUWM News Team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today.